Today's Cyprus International Podcast focuses on the Navy Calendar Year 23 Large-Scale Exercise, Associated Lessons Learned and Opportunities for Industry. It is moderated by Mr. Jim McCarthy, Vice President of Navy Programs, Cyprus International, and the participants are Admiral Jamie Fogo, former NAVIR Commander, and Admiral Scott Swift, former PAC Fleet Commander.
I want to thank everybody for joining us today. We're going to be talking today about the large-scale exercise conducted by the Navy this year and go into some detail about how industry could be involved in that and what industry can glean from being done in the large-scale exercise. I really wanted to start off first, if you could both briefly describe your role during LSE 23 this summer and how the Navy is using retired flags to stand in for administration personnel, officials, and umpires to assess outcomes. So, Jamie, why don't we start with you? If you could tell me where you were involved, please.
Sure thing, Jim. And it's a real delight to be here with you today on this podcast. Bottom line up front is that, you know, I was lucky. I was offered the position of senior mentor for the flag officers retired who were role-playing combatant commanders in Large Scale Exercise 23. And the reason that we had role-playing combatant commanders is because the real world was very busy. So we'll talk about the number of components and the number of numbered fleet commanders that were involved across 22 time zones, but we really needed these retired flag officers to be the purple team and to role-play all the different jobs across the globe. So it was a very experienced and collegial group of officers, all volunteers and all very enthusiastic to share experience with those who are fighting the good fight on active duty. And most of us are envious. Now, I had two roles to play myself. In this scenario, I was acting as the Secretary of Defense. And how cool is that? And the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Admiral Swift had a different role with the XCOM, and I'll let him talk about what he did.
Thanks, Jamie. Natso, could you cover what you did, please?
Yeah, thanks for that. The first thing, I'd start off with LSC 21 and the lessons that were applied out of that included both the HICON players that Jamie looked over, as well as my role in the white cell. And I would stress that Jamie and I have known each other for a long time. So while I didn't confuse things by role playing, Jamie and I stayed very close, both in managing the game, which was largely my responsibility to get at the game objectives. I mean, it was very, very complicated game. So having someone that was without decision authority, myself, that could provide advice to those that were the sponsors of the game, I think facilitated the process. It was significantly better with Jamie's participation, the joint players, as well as the white cell, which was much more empowered than the previous game.
So you raised the issue that there were was participation from outside Navy joint players. What other organizations participated in this? You know, how expansive was the participation? What was the Navy trying to get out of that, having observers come in and be part of the game? Admiral Fogo?
It's pretty interesting. There were, of course, Marine officers involved in this, and probably the biggest player from the Marine Corps was Lieutenant General Brian Kavanaugh, who's the commander of the Marine Forces Command down in Norfolk. And, you know, he was present for every interaction that we had with the officer in charge of the exercise, the guy who commissioned the exercise, Admiral Daryl Cottle, who was commander of Fleet Forces Command. Likewise, on the senior role-playing roster, we had two phenomenal Air Force general officers. Now, these guys assisted us with the role of the JFAC, the Joint Force Air Component Commander, understanding an air tasking order. And, you know, they teach schools down at Maxwell Air Force Base for Navy guys and Army guys to understand the ATO, but it was great to have that expertise in-house. And also, LIFT was a big part of the exercise, as it will be in any conflict the United States gets involved in. And so understanding Transportation Command at Scott Air Force Base in Illinois, and just overall a general understanding of the air picture from the service that does it best, and that's the folks who are in the light blue uniforms. You know, outside observers, we had lots of them. I give Admiral Cottle a lot of credit, Jim, because he really played his cards well here. You know, there were civilian leaders, policymakers, authorizers, appropriators, members of the joint force who came down and participated, you know, under the tent of FFC's large-scale exercise. You know, if you want, we can go into the four DB days, which to some people sounds excessive, but I think it was broken up into the right groups at the right time.
Thanks, Jamie. I'd like to see if we can cover the objectives the Navy has for getting at large-scale exercise. You know, what are they trying to get out of it? Are there areas where industry can help in improving the efficacy of whatever the LVC topology was? And, you know, ways in which we can make this LSE effort more effective for the Navy and get a better understanding of what the future requires. I would like to start with Admiral Swift, if you could give me your comments, please.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Jim. The first thing I would say is the difference in this large-scale exercise, as I mentioned earlier, in the first large-scale exercise was manifest itself in many ways. And one is the level of detail that the play got into. So, you know, I'm going to dance around this one a little bit just because of the classified nature of it. But let me just share that the overarching objective was to drive friction across three four-star commanders, the commander of Naval Forces Europe, the commander of Naval Forces NORTHCOM, and commander of the Pacific Fleet. And to drive that, the scenario drove conflicts and that drove risk in all three of those theaters that drove apportionment decisions. I think that's about as far as I can go there. I'll answer the LVC piece quickly and then turn it over to Jamie because I think he was much more directly involved in that piece. And I'll simply say, just to be cautious about measuring the success or failure of LVC in one exercise, there was actually, I had the benefit of playing in NLC 21, and I thought that the LVC play in 21 was much more robust, but the exercise wasn't as big. I mean, it was driven at a much higher strategic and operational level. Jamie mentioned the VIP visits, and there were field visits. There was incredible things that were being done in an LVC concept down on the East Coast, well, everywhere, certainly on the East Coast, but not to the same level of detail in LSC 21. I think that's a reflective of the training objectives, the design of the exercise that Admiral Cottle and Admiral Paparo and Admiral Munch were driving at. And that reduced the level of tactical play. That was recognized. And I think that in the next design, I won't say it will change. It'll focus on the objectives of the exercise itself. But I do think it's safe to say that LVC is a part of who the Navy is and all probably the Joint Force. I didn't see it as much there. But it is a great on-ramp for industry to participate. Many of the models that they're building, had a good discussion with folks that are making the LVC real, that with those models, they can be incorporated in the play as long as it's true to the game objectives.
Thanks. That's all, Jamie.
Jim, so I break up the question really into two parts. One, you know, what were the top line objectives of large scale exercise 23? And second, the typology. So let's just kind of look at top line objectives first. I wasn't part of LSC 21. I was a planner back when I was on active duty. It was delayed due to COVID, and I was retired by the time 21 came along. But I saw 23 up close and personal, and it was really the second iteration of large-scale exercise to reinforce the Chief of Naval Operations effort for advancing naval doctrine and tactics across the globe, and specifically to test distributed maritime operations capabilities, where we send the fleet out to sea and we disaggregate and we aggregate when we need the full firepower, you know, like the two carrier strike groups that are heading to the Eastern Mediterranean right now, and work with our closest partner. This was a Navy Marine Corps. I talked about the Air Force being part of this, but it was really a Navy Marine Corps exercise because the Marines were able to test expeditionary advanced base operations. Part of those field trips, we had the Senate Armed Services Committee, we had senior executives like yourself, Jim, that are serving in the Pentagon and political appointees who went down to North Carolina to see some of these forward refueling facilities out in the woods with the Marines. We had a large gaggle of reporters, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, U.S. Naval Institute, local newspapers, and finally, we had Joint Staff J7. That's really important for this part of the dialogue, and later, Lieutenant General Dag Anderson came down and was really interested in the exercise, and he asked me, hey, is any other service doing this? And, you know, my honest answer was, not that I know of, and I think we should be. And he was also impressed that we were working and testing all of this doctrine in cyber and space. And so we had the three maritime component commanders, five numbered fleets across 22 time zones. That's huge. No small task for Admiral Swift and his XCOM to try to keep this all on track. The whole idea is test future innovations without breaking the force. I mean, all this stuff's going on in real world. Ukraine, Gaza was not part of this at the time. It just happened. But the real world was keeping those numbered fleet commanders and those component commanders busy. So we didn't lay a readiness tax on them. We didn't send a lot of ships to sea. There were 75 ships involved, 25 at sea and 50 in port, who would go to various locations like Damneck, Virginia, and operate from maritime operations centers with a battle staff, but not the ship burning fossil fuels and keeping sailors away from their pillow at night. So it reduced op tempo and purse tempo, and that's commendable. On the typology, you know, when you look up the definition of typology, it's the way in which the constituent parts are interrelated or arranged. So live simulation means actual living people operating platforms and systems. So real soldiers, sailors, and airmen and Marines flying stuff, you know, running around in tanks, et cetera. Virtual simulation is real people controlling simulated weapon systems. So in our case, for some of those ships that were in port, they didn't go to sea, but you had a battle staff or you had a crew or an officer of the deck that was actually operating in a simulation with that platform. And then constructive simulation is the most unique and the one that's most fascinating to me. You know, when I started this business as an ensign in 1981, we didn't have anything like this. But now you can take a pilot avatar, you know, just like the movie, and fly an airplane. And the one that struck me when I was walking General Anderson around was, you know, we had a simulated adversary ship being reported by a simulated P-8 Marine patrol aircraft. And the video link from the simulated ship through the simulated airplane looked just like the real thing. And some of the folks that were going through the DV days were fooled by that. And I certainly was when I walked up on it. So, you know, that's real life, real world kind of simulation that can train the force. So when you bring all that together, our friends and our clients and people are out there in the defense industry are going to hear a lot about Navy Continuous Training Environment, NCTE. And I heard that a lot from the folks down at Naval Warfare Doctrine Command. And that is the network of simulators, simulations, simulation routing equipment, data translation devices, live training ranges that are plugged in these simulations in a live virtual constructive environment. So, you know, my message would be, if you're out there in the defense sector and you're producing any of that stuff, keep doing it. I think it's a safe bet. You know, one of the things that it allows us to do is to have sailors in training environments that are pretty hard to simulate at sea. So when you go out and do Comp 2X in the Virginia Capes op areas, and I've been out there in certification when I was in command of a submarine, it's not very often that you get a cooperative Chinese or Russian ship to come along and play in your exercise, right? Now, that day may come, and they are coming closer, which is why we do what we do. But having a simulation with those adversarial weapon systems, with accurate radars, SIGINT, and all that kind of stuff is really, really important to train the force. Another thing is friendlies. You know, you're going to have friendlies out there, and they're going to get in the way. I go back to the Vincennes incident. You guys remember that back shot at the Iranian airliner. It was July of 1988. Never forget it. Terrible, you know, a terrible thing that happened to the United States Navy and happened to that ship. Well, what if we'd run the Vincennes through one of these simulations six times? You know, I think maybe they would have pulled the airliner out of the weeds and said, that's not an adversary, that's a friendly, and it might have made a difference. And that's what you get out of this LVC. And the last thing I'll say is, bringing it all together, if industry can help bring it all together, we talk about JADC2, you know, Joint All Domain Command and Control, but yet each service has a different bundle that it's working on. So for the Navy, it's called Overmatch. For the Army, it's called Convergence. And for the Air Force, it's called Advanced Battle Management Systems. But none of it's funded together, and it doesn't really have a joint context. I hope the new chairman, General Brown, and I certainly know that Admiral Grady is working on this as the vice chairman to bring it all together. You know, and if they can, we were talking about kill chains for the last maybe 5 to 10 years of my time on active duty. That term is gone in the dustbin. Now it's kill web. Kill chain is kind of a singular or unitary approach. Find, fix, and finish the target. So you have one sensor, one weapon, one target, and you kill it. Nowadays, there's a spider web out there. You got a lot of sensors. You got a lot of weapons to choose from, and you can have multiple targets. And if you lose one of those sensors or lose one of those weapons, there's another one to fill in. So the kill web is the future, I think, of JADC2. And that's what we need to be testing. And I think what we are testing in live virtual conceptual training. Back to you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Jimmy. That's insightful. I want to kind of shift gears here a little bit without getting into any of the specifics of the exercise. I know a lot of that's probably classified. I'm sure there was a lot of learning, multiple levels in the exercise. There were some challenges. Probably there were some unrealistic aspects of the exercise. If Admiral Swift, I'm going to ask you to lead off this anyway. If you could highlight what you saw as sort of those overarching lessons learned, you know, not again, not specifics of, you know, what worked and what didn't work, and, you know, where that might be able to improve the exercise environment and how industry perhaps can play in that area.
This is an easy lift. There's a lot of great examples here to pull from. Jamie touched on them already. In the middle of large-scale exercise, unplanned, Admiral Gilday retired, and Admiral Franchetti took over the responsibilities of the office. And so Admiral Cottle ended up having to go up to D.C. with the other four stars. And he mentioned the great job that Lieutenant General Kavanaugh filled. Well, he was actually serving as the deputy JTF commander, the JIFMC commander in this exercise for NORTHCOM. And he continued in that role in Admiral Cottle's absence for 2 days running the exercise. I mean, it worked out very, very well. Now, that's not the first time it was done. It's been done multiple times before, although not to this scope and scale. So there were lessons learned that came out of that, of course, but it also validated a lot of concepts that had come out of the previous times that construct had been considered and applied. I'll use a real world. This isn't, this is about the application of learning. You know, I talk about speed often, and this is, I think, one of the things that comes naturally to Cyprus, and that is speed is interesting to me, but not fascinating. I can be really fast running in circles. What I want is velocity. The reason I am enjoying my association with Cyprus so much is I think Cyprus helps provide clients a vector, and that's what I saw in large-scale exercise, that there wasn't a specific point on the horizon that Admiral Munch and Admiral Cottle and Admiral Papara were driving towards, but they knew the general area that they wanted to drive to for the period of the game, and that provided a velocity to all those that were playing. I'll give you an example. A real-world example is USS Kearney in the Red Sea. When you look at the performance of Kearney compared to previous exercises, it's extraordinary. But that was a lot of push-ups and sit-ups. They were not valued by what we can see, certainly Jamie and I, and I won't speak for those in uniform, but we hear the same thing from them, the value that live virtual constructive provides. This gets back to the second part of your question with respect to industry. And I think if you apply the live virtual constructive concepts, not only across exercises, but also requirements definition, acquisition approach, we're going to reduce the cost by making both the operational and acquisition decisions much more informed in much less time. So I just finished a week-long war game up at the War College. It was a futures game. I won't say how much, not too far in the future, but it was fully informed by what industry is doing, being invited to participate across a spectrum of exercises, across a spectrum of fleets. That gave the commanders that were involved in that war game confidence that the capabilities that had been demonstrated, the technologies, that it was appropriate to say they would be here by year X. Plus, it gave them great insights as to the actual tactical capability that those innovations could provide and what impact it was postulated would have on the operational level of war. So the war game was designed around those elements. So this is we've gone beyond now the hypothetical. There's actually pieces that industry is doing that we can pull into the game. The one thing that I would say, I'll close on this point, is that industry participation needs to be codified. There's still too much of the sense of giving unfair advantage. It's very important. I'm not suggesting that we need to do away with that, but we need to look at it. It's like information sharing. It's not about protecting information. It's about the reality that we have a need to share. So we have a need to work with industry. The question becomes, how do we create on-ramps to that and instead of off-ramps to those bright ideas? Create those on-ramps into the operators so they have a better understanding at speed, with a vector, with velocity to deliver on that capability. I think it's there. I mean, I saw it in LLC. I saw it last week up at the War College. It's just a question of how do we get through the processes that allows a much fuller participation of industry. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Jamie, do you have an input here?
Yeah, I sure do, Jim. And if you break it down into two parts to your question, overall successes and challenges for the exercise, let me just run through kind of a laundry list that comes to mind. You know, first of all, I think it was successful in that LSE 23 helped develop TTP's training tactics and procedures to further support distributed maritime operations and littoral operations in a contested environment and expeditionary advanced base operations. So that's an uptick. Challenges, we've got to continue the investment in live virtual constructive technology and training. And, you know, that could be a $1 billion industry. There's a lot of money going into this, especially in building the kill web and then training our people on how to win with the kill web. Here's one, it's a challenge. It's not going to get any easier with some of the manpower shortages. You know, we're seeing that the Navy's down like 7,000 people this year. That's going to create gaps and seams. I mean, we're never fully manned anywhere on ships, on shore stations, in the Maritime Operations Center. And I think this exercise showed where the gaps and seams are and where we need the depth on the bench. So where do you want to make sure that you have, you know, a three-section watch of people that can continually man and answer questions on anti-air warfare, maritime interdiction operations, maritime domain operations, integrated air and missile defense. And so we showed some of those areas that will require attention. On the exercise design, I am fully supportive of having this combatant command replication process that we did with the retirees. I think it was very helpful and it took the load off of the Joint Force real world, and it allowed the training audience, who's everybody below the combatant commander, to actually be properly trained. We had one of our senior mentors, Vice Admiral Fozzie Miller. Fozzie was in my class at the Naval Academy in my company, and he made a very prophetic remark. He said, hey, World War II was actually two distinct wars happening simultaneously, one in the Pacific and another one in Europe. When you think about that, it's really true. But the next two theater war will be global in nature. So it'll be transparent across, you know, bodies of water and landmass. I think that's important to realize. That's why live virtual constructive is in 22 time zones and connecting all these people together globally is important. We probably need to do some more work operating in a contested environment. It's easy to ignore that. And then when you go into the fight, you lose precision navigation and timing, or you lose communications, you're going to have to figure out what to do to work around it. This was a U.S. exercise. You know, I'm a big proponent of NATO, as you are, Jim, and I think sooner or later, hopefully sooner, we got to bring the allies and partners in on this. I said it in Trident Juncture, and I'll say it again in Large Scale Exercise 23. Logistics is the sixth domain of warfare. It was the downfall of the Russians in Ukraine in the beginning of their campaign, and we need to pay attention to it. And that said, we got to have more combat logistics force. We have Admiral Swift and I talk all the time about the need for more than just two submarine tenders, more than just 10 ships in the tanker security program to get fuel into the fleet. And we've got to restock our ordnance and reload after the amount of ammunition that we've used up supporting Ukraine and that we will use in support of Israel. I think hybrid warfare is very important and it's a challenge. We had Fourth Fleet in play. You know, they're the new playground by direction of the Secretary of the Navy for unmanned systems. And that's got to be worked at a higher level in Large Scale Exercise 25. And the final thing I'll say And this goes back to my conversation with Lieutenant General Dag Anderson, the Joint Staff J7, is what is the Joint Staff's role in the next large-scale exercise 25? Do we want to keep this as a Navy Marine Corps exercise and continue to work our TTPs, or do we want to go beyond that? And there's pros and cons to both.
Thanks very much for both of your inputs. Very interesting. I'd like to kind of close out with one specific question on this, probably on the minds of industry. I understand that the exercise is likely to be continued in the Navy. There's a lot they get out of it, but industry is really interested in how they can get their kit into an exercise like this and show that, you know, whatever thing they've got can help move the needle, make stuff that we have more effective, or new things that might help make the systems or the challenges less complex to the operators. Are there, you know, mechanisms, processes that are better suited to feeding LSE 25? And what would those avenues be? How do you pursue that? Jamie, why don't you start off, please?
Yeah, this is a really great question. It's a hard question too, Jim, because, you know, everybody that's out there, thanks to Admiral Darrell Cottle and watching the strategic communications and the public affairs messaging and the DV days and the newspaper articles that came out of this, are saying, hey, how do I get involved? To your point, how do I move the needle? How can I help the sea services with, you know, DMO and Expeditionary Advanced Base Operations for the Marines? And finding an on-ramp is often difficult. I mean, you just can't walk into Fleet Forces Command headquarters and say, hey, I got this new gadget that I want to sell you that's going to make large-scale exercise 25 even better. And the same with NWDC, Naval Warfare Development Command. It doesn't happen that way. And a lot of industry, in your industry panels this past year at Sierra Space, Cyprus conducted a gathering of CEOs, COOs, and CFOs. The question was, you know, how do we survive the valley of death? I mean, we come up with, you know, venture capital, we have an idea and we try to prototype that idea and then we try to sell it to DOD and we run into the valley of death and it fizzles out and we lose money and we never sell it and it becomes, you know, something in the dustbin of history for our company. There are ways to get in. And, you know, one of them is the Navy Small Business Innovative Research Program. It is for smaller companies and startups, but it can also be for anybody that has a good idea. And it works in a couple of different ways. There's a mechanism here. It's not complicated, but every couple of months, I think three times a year, the Navy comes out with a broad area announcement of some question or some problem they're trying to solve. And those problems or questions come from the Office of Naval Research, from Naval Sea Systems Command, from NAVAIR, from SSP, the Strategic Systems Programs Office. And if you go online, you can see these questions and these problems. And, you know, I'll just read you one of them. In the last BAA, NAVC had an open question on operations and logistics in a contested environment. How do we improve launch and recovery of air, sea, surface, and unmanned underwater vehicles from naval vessels? You know, so that's a fairly finite problem for somebody who's got an expertise in onloading or offloading UUVs and tethering or non-tethering UUVs to solve. And as you go through this process, you have to compete with everybody else out there that has a good idea how to solve that problem. And the Navy will tell you after phase one feasibility, they'll look at it and say, okay, you graduated to phase two, which is the demonstration phase. Now go build a prototype and show us it works. And then if you win, you get a contract, and that's the commercialization phase when you're now producing large numbers of these for Navy and Marine Corps. So that's an avenue. And assisting those individuals who want to get on that on-ramp is Naval X. I'm a huge fan of Naval X, started by our friend Hondo Gertz when he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Research, Development, and Acquisition. There's 18 Naval X offices around the world. They're called Tech Bridges. They recently opened a new one in Yokosuka, Japan, London, England. There's one in Hawaii. There's one in the National Capital Region, and I've been to them. You walk in, and there's a bunch of young people holding a laptop and picnic benches, and you sit down, and you talk about a problem that you think you can solve as a small business or an industry that the Navy is trying to get its arms around, Navy or Marine Corps, and then they'll take it from there. And perhaps you'll end up with one of these small business innovation research loans, or better, you know, get to work with one of the defense primes in solving this problem. So a couple of avenues of approach, not the be-all and end-all. And I know Admiral Swift probably has better ideas than I do.
Not so, please.
Sorry, no better ideas, just more of them. I'll share some personal experiences that Jamie's comments triggered in my mind. And the first one is when I was a PAC fleet commander, I tried to be as open as I possibly could to conversations with industry, including personal conversations in my office and broader conversations as well. I'll expand on that in just a moment. But I was always struck in my personal conversations is a lot of times industry would come in with a widget and hand me the widget and say, this is going to rock your world. And I'd take the widget and I'd put it down and I'd say, tell me about my world. And the conversation would end. Whose fault is that? That's my fault. Because I've mentioned this before, we put these barriers of conversation between those in uniform and industry. It is crazy when we're facing threats like peer threats such as China and significant threats such as Russia. And look at what's going on in Gaza right now. We mentioned Carney already. There needs to be a much deeper integration between the innovative juices that are resident out there in industry, whether it's large industry or small industry. So that's an example of how we made a difference. How we made a difference, you know, the lawyers, and I'm not blaming them, they're great folks and were very helpful to me when I was the PAC fleet commander coming up with a solution. So, you know, the problem was I couldn't share anything privately with one company that wasn't available publicly. That's to Jamie's point of competition. So I give credit to my N9 ward, which was being run by Dave Yoshihara at the time, that came up with a concept to see a dream. So we briefed, you know, I think it was upwards of 300 different industries were represented. I think we did it every other year just because it was so big. And we briefed them in at the secret level, got them all in the theater over there on the sub base, Jamie. And I gave them a brief of a thumbnail of what I thought war in the Pacific would look like. And so we need to move away from, I would turn the question around a little bit. I'm really not interested in how industry can show how their products might help in moving the needle. What we need to tell them is the challenges that we have with moving the needle and gaps and seams so they can go out, as Jamie pointed out, they can go out and embrace those technologies in ways that can better solve the problems we have. Once I told industry, tell me about my world, the next conversation we had, well, the rest of that conversation was about my world. The next conversation we had, they would come back and say, we listened to you. We thought about it. We think that these things may make a difference. And you know what? They were right about 80% of the time. That's a pretty darn good success level, I think. So this is what live virtual constructive can rapidly accelerate if we embrace it from a concept that must be implemented. It must be implemented with bridges across those traditional barriers that we've had. I'll give you a couple of examples. Jamie brought up, just to reinforce, the first thing is to better understand the gaps and seams at the operational and tactical levels, and then so industry can bring technology that really makes a difference. Jamie talked about the challenge we have with manning. That's not going to go away. It's a problem that's only getting more and more difficult as it becomes more and more difficult to recruit sailors into all the military forces. In this case, we're talking about the Navy. Look what automation does to truly reducing the required for manpower. How do we graphically present very tactical displays of a laydown of tactical forces, operational forces, and the effects that they can create to counter our own capability? Those are things that we should be doing and focusing on, I think, at a higher level. I think that's where Admiral Gilday was going when he was talking about unmanned. Unmanned is not about getting rid of people. Unmanned is having a more effective and efficient force that doesn't require all that HM&E stuff in it that we need when it's manned. And I'll close on this point. Jamie keyed this in my mind. I've mentioned it before. Two points. I haven't mentioned it in a while. We used to talk about sensor to shooter. I started talking about data to weapon, and I was corrected by Air Force general who said, you know, it's really not about sensor to shooter. It's not about data to weapon. It's about data to effect. We need to stop talking about cyber as if it's something completely different. Space is a domain, but it's not about the effects it creates. The effects that we create from space, from the sea, from land, from the seabed, it's all relevant to the warfight. And then I will close on this point. This is the why, how, what. We need to explain industry why their participation is important. Have that conversation of what they can contribute based on what their level of expertise is and what our challenges are. And that once we talk about that, why it's so important to break down these barriers, then we can talk about the problems and talk about how to solve them. This isn't even a specific effect or a specific widget. What is in that constellation of technologies out there, of capabilities, how do we solve this problem? And then we get to the acquisition problem of selecting the what. We can make that whole process much more effective if we are much more engaged across all of DoD and all of industry, not just the defense complex, to talk about the why this is a problem, how is it that we can solve it, and finally get to the what. But when we see a crisis, the first thing we go to is a what. It's kids' soccer. We need to break down that field and understand that it's a much broader and more challenging problem to understand, and we can get to that understanding if we do it collectively and integratedly.
Thanks, guys. Very, very insightful, as always. Let me just kind of, I want to end with one question. You know, what's the question that I forgot to ask that you wish that I'd included in this that might be of value to industry and to the audience? So start with you, Admiral Swift.
Yeah, I will tell you, I'm challenged to think of something we haven't covered. I mean, I very much, and this may sound like I'm patting Cyprus on the back here, but I think that when you look at the constellation of folks that Cyprus has pulled together, I walk away from, I probably shouldn't be saying this to you, Jim, but I walk away with more value than I think I'm providing to Cyprus. It's an extraordinary environment. And just this example, I hope that I contributed as much to the LSC series of war game, in this specific case, LSC 23, as I got out of it. But man, teaming with somebody like Jamie, the conversations that he and I had about challenges that we hadn't even been exposed to if we hadn't have been there in the exercise, it's just extraordinary. So there's nothing that comes to my mind. And I guess I'll close on that point. We need to bring industry into that circle. We do it because Jamie and I are committed to make the Navy better. You know, this is looking back and doing as much for them as they have done through us for our careers. So we need to take that and industrialize it, if you will, and bring industry into that same circle. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Jamie.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, thanks to Admiral Swift for his kind words, and I couldn't say enough about him and how he ran that exercise. I mean, extremely complicated, like 900 people on the XCOM team doing injects and then having to make sure that the timing was realistic across these 22 time zones so that the training audience got the most out of it. So bravo Zulu to Admiral Swift, Scott and his team. It was really professionally executed, as is everything that you do at Cyprus, Jim. And, you know, when we talked about how do you garner the attention of the folks on active duty or our civilian leaders in the Navy that are putting together an exercise like LSC 23 or in the future LSC 25, and how hard it is to get time and get attention. I love Admiral Swift, and he's kind of a unicorn, you know, a guy that's willing to take the time to talk to people in his office, assemble, you know, people in an auditorium, sea of dreams, and bring them in and explain to them what we're doing so they can help us solve our problems. You know, I was chuckling when he was talking about that, because I remember, you know, Admiral Dave Oliver, retired, writes some great books. Lead On, which I read as a junior officer. He's got one, Against the Tide, about Admiral Hyman G. Rickover. We just commissioned the second ever Admiral Hyman G. Rickover, my classmate, company mate, Frank Caldwell, up there on the dais for that magnificent ship. And how did that ship get to be so magnificent? You know, because Rickover was a brilliant architect. I mean, he wasn't the smartest engineer, but he knew how to bring people together. It was like Oppenheimer, you know, and he put this thing together. One of the things he did was he invested his personal time and energy in making sure that every component of that ship was reliable. And one of the funny stories from Rickover's background over in Crystal City, that's the old NR buildings where I interviewed, and I'm sure you did, Jim. You know, when I was an ensign, or not even, I was a midshipman at the Naval Academy, but Rickover had the office on the 10th floor. People would bring him stuff and they would say, I have the best electrical breaker, you know, for your propulsion plant that has ever been made. And he's like, really? Will it be able to survive a depth charge, you know, shock damage, battle damage? And they'd say, yes, sir, it will. You know, you need to buy this. You need to buy it in quantity. Put it on all your submarines. So he'd open the window from the 10th floor and throw it out. And it would hit the tarmac on the deck below near the trash cans. And if the breaker stayed shut, he would buy it. If the breaker popped open, that guy got thrown out the window next. You know, we can't do that anymore. So there's got to be another on-ramp. And I really think one of the most effective on-ramps, other than, you know, SBIRs and Naval X and everything else, is Cyprus. The people that work there are extraordinary. Jim, you yourself have told me many, many times you've done 26 POMs. Nobody knows more about the POM than you do. And your briefs are exceptional. Frankly, better than some that I hear in the five-sided building. So folks should take advantage of that expertise and, you know, let us help them as they have all these great ideas and innovations that they want to help the Joint Force get better.
Thanks very much, both of you. And look forward to our next podcast, whenever that may be, and whatever on whatever subject we end up using.